Welcome to the Mormon News Report, your weekly dose of Mormonism. We've got a great show lined up for you this week. We'll be discussing child brides, religious freedom, race, polygamy, parades, patriotism, and more.
You know, Brian, that's what we call a normal Tuesday night in the Malone household. And of course, we're discussing these things. It's a Mormon show. What else would we discuss?
We also have special guest James Goldberg with us today.
So I'm sure that the name, the Mormon News Report podcast, might throw a few of our listeners off base, Brian. So let's just level set everything right now. We've been doing this month in Mormon studies for just about a year now. And we decided, you know, there's so much information out there. There's a lot more stuff that we want to cover. We decided to call this the Mormon News Report. It's a creation that takes the Mormon News Report email newsletter, takes our fun and wonderful personalities, and boom, this is how we go. So the Mormon News Report is going to be a weekly podcast that focuses on the general news topics and featured guests. We're still going to be discussing relevant and timely blog posts. We're going to talk about podcasts that catch our ears and the discussions on Mormon academia and scholarship. We'll be discussing that here, but we're not going to go too in-depth. We might just touch on a few things here and there. The in-depth stuff we're going to save for this month in Mormon studies, and that's still going to go out on a monthly basis.
But we're going to be doing regular guest interviews on this show, and we'll be inviting some of the movers and shakers in Mormon scholarship, as well as the arts, culture, entertainment. Heck, who knows, Brant, maybe even some business leaders or sports figures. I think it's going to be fun. What do you think?
I think that if we can get some business leaders and sports figures on here, we've hit the big time.
With that said, let's get on with the show.
All right. So, Brian, let's get into the news. Big news that happened this week. Utah's Zion's curtain fell and their state's tight liquor laws were loosened just a little bit. So, Brian, Zion's curtain is something that was always very weird for me as an outsider for Utah. Essentially, it's a glass partition that separates the bartenders preparing the alcoholic drinks from the customers who ordered them because, you know, you can't see people making alcoholic drinks or it's going to really, really mess with some people. So usually it's frosted glass because you can't see anything. And what happened this week was House Bill 442, which was an amendment to Utah's alcohol laws, was passed, which means that some of those partitions can come down. And many of the outlets this week covered the specifically, I'm thinking of NPR, which actually showed someone pushing the glass down and breaking it and shattering it all over the place.
I mean, Brant, I can kind of understand this concern. Have you ever seen those poor Mormon parents just trying to go out and enjoy a meal in a restaurant with their six kids in tow? I mean, their kids are running around the dining room, they're running in the kitchen, they're jumping off chairs, they're hanging from the light fixtures. Those poor parents just have this look of pain and resignation on their faces. The last thing that they need to be reminded of is that there is a remedy for all of this called alcohol. I say that it's best to just keep it out of sight and out of mind.
Apparently so. So I take it you're against House Bill 442.
Just for those reasons stated, Brant.
For those reasons alone, yeah.
It's been a bad couple of weeks for the FLDS Church. Lyle Jeffs, who's the brother of Warren Jeffs and the bishop of the FLDS Church, was arrested on June 30th in connection with labor violations. And now this from Fox 13. Alyssa Wall was married to her 19-year-old cousin at age 14 in a ceremony conducted by Warren Jeffs. Now, Wall is seeking as much as $22 million from Jeffs and two corporate entities that are tied to the FLDS Church. The hearing has ended. The Third District Court Judge Keith Kelly said, "I have a lot to deliberate," but didn't say when he would rule on the case. Now, you know, Brant, there's really no way to make this story funny. Cases like this, where children are being married off to their cousins, no less, should be taken very seriously. But what it does make me wonder, what are these two corporate entities that are tied into the FLDS Church? I don't know, maybe one of them manufactures those stylish pastel prairie dresses that the FLDS women wear. I'd love to meet the designer.
Oh, right.
Here's the designer. I'm thinking 1880s homesteader meets 1980s high school prom. What do you think?
You know, as long as we've got a lot of poofing with the hair for the females, I think we're going to be sold. I think there's a market for it is what I'm saying. In other news this week, a GOP senator tells the BYU audience that Trump's policies test religious freedom. So this is from the Salt Lake Tribune. U.S. Senator Jeff Flake said Thursday that progress has been made protecting religious freedom, but recent tests, including White House policies, are challenging the liberties of minority faiths. Speaking at Brigham Young University, the Arizona Republican and, might I add, fellow Mormon, expressed concern about President Donald Trump's bans on citizens from Muslim-majority countries. Quote, "This process will take time and the course will remain a gamble," Flake said at a conference on the topic at BYU's Provo campus. "Given the political environment, measurable achievements in Congress will also remain an iffy proposition." Wood also covers more of the Religious Freedom Annual Review and found a very surprisingly fresh take on things. He found that the focus was more on other religions other than Christianity in regards to religious freedom, specifically minority faiths.
Brand, if you couldn't tell by your neighbors blowing up stuff until midnight every night this past week, our nation celebrated its 241st year since our own Brexit.
You know, Brian, we were Brexiting since before it was cool. I would even dare say we are Brexit hipsters.
Brexit hipsters. I mean, that we were. Utah is known for putting on a ridiculously large 4th of July fireworks show, which I always find just a little bit ironic, considering that the reason that Utah exists is because its Mormon settlers were fleeing from what they felt was persecution under a tyrannical government that didn't honor their freedom. In a way, it kind of feels like overcompensation. Like, you know, when it came time for Utah to become a state, we decided to prove our loyalty to the nation by buying like the biggest fireworks in town. We're those neighbors. Brant, you know, Colorado is over there like, go home, Utah, you're drunk.
Yeah, well, I have this feeling that Colorado is too busy lighting up a few other things, so.
That's right. Well, nowhere in Utah is our red-blooded, bald-headed eagle more on display than at the Provo Freedom Festival, unless that is if you're an organization that provides community resources and counseling for the LGBTQ community. The nonprofit organization called Encircle had its permit to walk in the parade revoked because this non-political organization was deemed to be an advocacy group. Many people are outraged about this. They call it un-American, but you know what I think? I think that I know the real reason why their permit to participate in this parade was revoked.
Oh boy, here we go.
Okay, so I think the real reason that they revoked them was because they knew that whatever float the LGBTQ community helped come together to help build would be far too fabulous to compete with. It would have been unfair to the other floats, really. I mean, there would have been rainbows, there would have been glitter, there would have been unicorns, there would have been show tunes. How do you compete with that?
Well, speaking of competing with that, let's go on to arts and entertainment because I think they might have some competition for it. So Jana Reese had a very interesting piece up this week where she talks about the LDS Arts Festival that was going on in New York City. And she asks a pretty provoking question. Where are the Mormon Shakespeares and Michelangelos? So here's what she writes. What I came away with in that talk, and this is a talk that was given at the LDS Arts Festival in New York, was that community is the Mormon Shakespeare. The lone genius paradigm is not our jam. That's not to say we don't have immensely talented individuals in our midst, many of whom I've been privileged to meet here at the festival. But it means that Mormons' particular gift for pulling together, believing that our individual efforts are part of something bigger, that we have a responsibility to nurture one another. Right now at the festival, I'm listening to musician Nathan Thatcher introduce fellow Mormon artist Francisco Estevez, whom he assiduously tracked down in Spain when he first discovered Estevez's music. Thatcher is visibly excited at the joy of introducing this composer, about whom he has now written the book.
So I don't know, asking where the Mormon Shakespeares and Michelangelos are is a bit of a high bar to start out with, don't you think? I mean, can't we start out with a little bit of a lower bar, like, you know, where's the Mormon Andy Warhols? I'm thinking 50 Shades of Jell-O installation pieces. You know what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying, but let me say this. Let me say this. I will say that I think that part of the reason why she's having this conversation is because, and I want to say it was Spencer W. Kimball who had talked about that there's going to be Mormon Shakespeares and Mormon Michelangelos out there. But I think what she's saying is valuable in the sense of, yes, there's a lot of good talent out there, but I think that you're right. Maybe let's not shoot for like the best of the best. Let's get second tier first before we start going after that. I'm okay if there's a Mormon Andy Warhol out there.
You're right. Or a Mormon Stephanie Myers. Wait a second. She is Mormon.
Wait, that's let's back it up there a little bit. So more news coming out of Utah, and I can hear the tears from Utah all the way over here in Detroit, including those of my wife who was at Utah right now. The Hamilton star, Christopher Jackson, who played George Washington in the musical, was scheduled to be at the Utah Pioneer Day concert in conjunction with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. Brian, tragedy has struck Utah. Christopher Jackson will not be there. According to a release from the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, quote, due to unavoidable and unanticipated scheduling conflicts with the filming of his current TV series, Christopher Jackson will be unable to join the Mormon Tabernacle Choir and Orchestra at Temple Square for their annual Pioneer Day concerts on July 14th and 15th. Mr. Jackson is sincerely disappointed at this turn of events and is looking forward to another opportunity to appear with the choir and orchestra in the future. Singer Alex Boyer will be replacing Christopher Jackson. And from what I've heard on the internet, it's kind of, okay.
Well, I mean, the good news is that at least they stuck with a guy who has the same haircut. I'm going to be really snarky here for a second, Brant, and say honestly, I wonder how many Mormons would have just assumed that Christopher Jackson was Alex Boyer in here, right?
I mean, you know, you dress up. No, I'm not even going to say it. I'm not going to say
it. They're like, oh, he's a lot lighter than his pictures made him look.
I mean, from a distance, they probably look the same, but.
We're so white.
and when I say they probably look the same, I mean it's because they're both bald, you know?
Bald, exactly. Bald.
So let's get into the blogs on the interwebs that caught our eye this week. The first one that caught my eye, and Brian, I know this was passed around far and wide, by Common Consent had a great piece by Angela C. called Death by Correlation Committee. And we talked in the past on the This Month in Mormon Studies podcast, one of the most essential things if you're writing a paper or you're making a blog post, titles matter. Death by Correlation Committee. So here's what she says. She talks about one of my personal pet peeves within the church. I've even said that it's a necessary evil. I don't like it, but I understand why you have to have it, which is the nature of correlation within the LDS church. It's a really good analysis of the current processes that are currently going on, specifically how things are getting done, a little bit about how the sausage is made. And while she doesn't offer solutions, the questions that she poses for the commenters are very thought-provoking. And Brian, this is another one of those pieces where, read it, she definitely has some good information in there. She lays out all the issues and really the nature of correlation really well. But then the commenters are really where the good stuff's at.
You know, when I hear the title Death by Correlation Committee, it makes me think of Monty Python's Spanish Inquisition skits that they did, right? And I always figured that Death by Correlation Committee was when you like veered off of the Sunday school manual while you're teaching.
Yeah.
And then the correlation committee just like barges into the room. Nobody expects the correlation committee. Anyway, LDS Perspectives podcast is consistently one of our favorite shows. We talk about it regularly over at our other show, This Month in Mormon Studies. Well, their most recent episode has been gaining some traction. It discusses race-based priesthood restriction that until 1978 prohibited African or African-American men from being ordained to the priesthood.
As well as prohibiting African or African-American men and women from entering LDS temples.
Right. Well, Nick Gallietti interviewed members of the Genesis group on this topic. And I got to be honest, Brant, when I first heard about this, I was like, what in the world would Phil Collins know about the Mormon priesthood, man?
You know, listen, give Phil Collins and Genesis a little bit of credit. They've written a few songs, Land of Confusion, Misunderstanding. Don't you denigrate Phil Collins in front of me, Brian.
Well, the Genesis group, as it turns out, is an official auxiliary of the LDS church that was founded in 1971 as sort of a branch with a charge to fellowship and meet the needs of the growing number of African-American members. Today, the Genesis group meets on the first Sunday of every month in Salt Lake City, more as a support group. In recent years, the membership has really grown. It's grown over 300 members, and it comprises all different ethnicities. Many come to experience a less traditional, and some would say, probably including myself, a more fun way of experiencing Mormon worship service. So Nick Gallietti interviewed the presidency members along with their wives of the Genesis group about the history of the group, their views on the recent gospel topic essay that addressed race and priesthood, as well as kind of what their monthly devotional meeting and organizational structures look like. Brant, I mean, honestly, I think that this may be the only devotional service in the entire LDS church where music is sung at a faster pace than funeral dirge.
You know, Brian, to build on that, it might be the only service where members actually stay awake through the whole thing, too.
All right, we'll be back after this break with James Goldberg.
If you're looking for more current events coverage, why don't you try the Mormon News Report? The Mormon News Report is a weekday email sent hot and fresh to your inbox every day by 8 a.m. covering the top stories in Mormonism with a tiny bit of snark. Our focus is on actual news from actual newspapers and reporters covering all aspects of Mormonism. If you're interested in signing up, email mormonnewsreport@gmail.com with your name and zip code. We use that for demographic purposes. You can like the Mormon News Report on Facebook, find us on Twitter at The Mormon News, or visit theculturalhall.com/mormon-news-report for more.
Apologetics can be defined as a defense of faith through argumentation. Christian apologetics comprise some of the earliest forms of Christian writings. Throughout the centuries, apologists have argued for the reality of God, legitimacy of Scripture, the creation, the fall, the preeminence of grace, and the eschatology of the end times. Adding to these, Mormon apologists have defended Joseph Smith's first vision, the embodiment of God, continuing revelation, extra-biblical scripture and temple rituals, among other topics, and have reached new levels of sophistication through training in fields such as history, philosophy, and Near Eastern languages and culture. Through multiple perspectives, the contributors to this volume explore the textures and contours of apologetics, revealing deep ideological fissures within the Mormon Studies community concerning its utility. In spite of these deep-seated differences, what each author has in common is a passion for Mormonism and how it is presented and defended. This volume captures that reality and allows readers to encounter the terrain of Mormon apologetics at close range. Learn more about Perspectives on Mormon Theology, Apologetics, by visiting gregcoford.com.
All right, we have on today James Goldberg. James, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
James is kind of a special guy. He's had some involvement with the Church History Department. We're going to talk a little bit about a couple of his projects and some of the other things that are going on, especially with some of his other projects that he's working on. So, Brian, why don't you kick us off?
Yeah, James, now you and I, we've been friends for a long time. I think it's fair to say that, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I can comment on your glorious beard, for instance, and you won't take offense to that, right? And James, no, James really does have a glorious beard. In fact, that beard has gotten James a few acting jobs, from
That's
what I
true.
Understand. Yeah. So why don't we lead in with that? Let's talk about some of the acting that you've done, and then let's talk a little bit about your unique background ethnically.
Okay. So acting first, I actually trained in theater more as a playwright and director than an actor, but I did some actor. I was great. The clown unit. I was so good. It was great training. My makeup class, I was great. I'm a little rusty there, but I did when my daughter had a Monster High birthday party. I did some pretty good Monster High makeup on those girls, and maybe myself. We won't discuss that anyway. Film work, you end up being kind of a human doll more than an actor most of the time. But I've been a doll in a number of church productions when they did the Bible videos. They're shooting Book of Mormon videos right now. And I look, sort of ancient Jerusalem, but taller. And I'm also in a feature-length film called The Yankles about a yeshiva baseball team. So Orthodox rabbis in training start their own baseball team for intercollegiate athletics, and there's a comedy about it, and I am the rabbi who was too inept. You know, I spill my juice or whatever, and they decide they'll pick the other guy as the coach. It was good.
So you're more than a prop in this movie, a bearded prop in this movie.
No, I'm still basically, you know, sometimes you're reduced to your physical beauty.
Well, let's talk more about your physical beauty, James. Where does this come from? Where does your luster?
So I do have four grandparents, which is a little bit below the national average, but barely common to have four grandparents. My dad's dad was Jewish. They were his parents both came over from Romania before World War II, of course. And then my mom's dad came over from Punjab state in India. It actually, there's a Punjab in India and Pakistan now. When he was 12 years old, it split. His best friend ended up going Pakistan side. He stayed India side and then immigrated to the United States in the 1950s and became, you know, maybe the first Sikh Mormon. There may have been other Sikh converts to Mormonism, but I haven't found any recorded. And then, so both my grandmothers are from Mormon families. My maternal grandmother comes from the colonies in Mexico, goes back through Helam and Pratt to Parley P. Pratt's the name people know. And then my other grandma was from one of those Utah, California families with both sides. The inventor of Coca-Cola, who sold it to that pharmacist and...
Oh.
Lost the family all the money we might have otherwise had is on that line. So
there's no bitterness.
That's a very tragic history in that way, my family history.
Now you've also authored some books.
We might have a chance to talk to this, but I was at the Mormon Arts Center Festival this past week. And it was the weirdest, it was a great experience. Super cool to be talking to these artists across genres, but you know, we have some kind of shared questions about how do you express a certain way of being. But it was fun there to be in a place where people have read my work, which is not typically something that happens. But you know, when people are coming up and go, hey, are you James Goldberg? The Five Books of Jesus is one of my favorite books. That's just not a thing that happens on the street, you know? So yeah, The Five Books of Jesus is a novel that's the story from the Synoptic Gospels, but kind of putting you in the point of view of people there in Jesus' ministry. And and what is it like to be thinking from the perspective of that culture and to be with Jesus, not knowing what's coming next, because we know the end of the story, they didn't.
Right.
And so I think a lot of people like that. The five books title confuses basically everyone. And so maybe it's not a great title, but it's because it's structured as five books based on the five books of Moses. The Gospels use the Old Testament as kind of a structure. And I think the first people who heard the story knew that, right? And we don't know the Old Testament as well, so we don't tend to do that. So, but I've done some overt structuring that it's kind of candy, right? You can read through the book and it's just this story about Jesus, right? This guy and what he's doing. And there's a fairly easy to access text, but then that has a lot of this, like, you know, other scriptural references in the way I structure stories or whatever. So the five books of Jesus is kind of my most popular thing.
Just real quick, do you think, do a lot of people assume because of the title that it's an apocalyptic, like they're looking at some of the, not apocalyptic, sorry, what am I looking for?
Apocryphal?
Yeah, apocryphal.
Because it is kind of apocalyptic. Everybody's convinced the world is going to end. They're listening to Jesus. But yeah, it's apocryphal.
You think readers are assuming if they come across a title that it's an apocryphal?
No, I think they're confused because there's four gospels, but I say five. So
okay.
I mean, maybe that's, I think they just think I'm numerically challenged. But they're generous.
It was a typo, right? It was a typo.
It was a typo.
So James, let me ask you.
Yeah.
Because you had mentioned being at the New York Art Festival. Mm-hmm. So Janet Reese wrote a great piece earlier this week about the art festival, and she started with this provocative title: "Where are the Mormon Shakespeare's and the Mormon Michelangelo's?" When you were at the art festival, did you see some of that there?
The Shakespeare's and Milton's of Mormonism. So Janet Reese's presentation actually, I think, did a good job talking about how we're kind of better as a community at like different collective endeavors. So she talked about genre fiction. Mm-hmm. And how we've got some great genre writers because that's a more communal form than the sort of like solitary writer in a shack somewhere, you know, producing great art. Mormons aren't good at the lonely, tortured genius. It's really hard to get lonely as a Mormon.
Yeah.
But anyway, what I tell people when they ask about that is I feel like Brandon Sanderson is the Mormon Dostoevsky. He's got these epic fantasy novels that are also really interesting sort of moral discourses where you'll have a question raised in one scene with one set of characters and then kind of implicitly answered with other characters later, which is a very Dostoevsky thing to do. As far as painters and stuff, there's interesting things. One thing I guess I'll say quickly from that thing, Laura Hurtado, who's the curator at the Church Museum of Art, talked about what is Mormon art. And gave us a minute to just talk to our neighbor about what we think. And I said, you know, there's lots of definitions of Mormon art different people have kind of thrown out and debated, and there's merits. But the one that I like, the subset of Mormon art I'm most interested in, is defined by the audience, art that resonates in some way with Mormons. And I think sometimes we're looking for, like, who's the Mormon superstar that will give us the sort of like cultural affirmation that we crave because we have this provincial self-doubt and we want someone else to tell us that we're good so we can go, oh, yes, we have great art. And I'm not that interested in that. Like, it's just not important to me. But art that's really resonant with Mormons is. So I like people like, I don't know, Brian Koshiznik, the painter. I was talking to him some. There was a piece of his I really loved with four different short paintings about, I don't know, death and that spirit world, physical world line and some fun stuff there. And I really enjoyed the presentation by Jorge Coco Santangelo, however you say that. He's an Argentine painter who does like recognizable Bible scenes, right? So like kids can see his art and know what it is, but he does it in this kind of abstracted style. He jokingly calls it sacro-cubism. That gives you that little bit of distance, right? Because I think sometimes people can think of a super realistic painting as if that's actually how Jesus looked or something. I love, he's got a first vision where you can kind of, because of the geometry of it, see the pillars of light, right? And Joseph Smith too, it's mostly this more two-dimensional look, but Joseph Smith's leg is kind of rounded, so it's almost like he's falling out of the painting, right? And you have this neat kind of like where do the physical world and spiritual world meet in a moment of vision? And I don't know, as a Mormon, to me, I kind of like that better than some of the like classical greats, because there's other layers of connection I have with that, right? Mm-hmm. So for me, I feel like we're doing a pretty good job starting with getting Mormons who speak in a deep way to Mormon experience. And as a reader and a viewer, I feel like we're pretty lucky. And yeah, I think there's more to go. And a lot of people don't know about these artists and writers, but I do think people are producing stuff now that's totally worth time and attention. I was in charge of an informal sort of side event that was a reading. During one of the lunch breaks, we got people together to just read Mormon poetry and flash fiction and stuff. Faith Kirschisnik, who's married to Brian Kirschisnik, read a cool piece about the dream Adam has when he's in that deep sleep, right? And nice. they're making Eve, and just fun. Again, yeah. Stuff Mormons would think about more. A lot of people were interested. You're asking about my books. I've got a poetry collection called Let Me Drown with Moses. The title poem's about, you know, if you're about to go through the Red Sea and you're looking at this water and you're not sure if it's going to stay up all the way across, you have the speaker saying, if these walls of water follow, Lord, let me drown with Moses, right? And basically saying, you know what, it was worth it to follow a prophet and to think of life as more than sort of the mundane nature of slavery in Egypt, just to be here. And if I die, I die, right? I also have a section in that book that are poems about Mormon history, you know, both the early period and like, I've got a poem about the Third Convention in Mexico. So this sort of early mid 20th century thing in Mexico that's super interesting. Nobody knows about, got a poem about it. And it was tons of fun to be able to share those poems with people who are checked into this, right? Where this is their history, their heart, that kind of thing. And you know, there were a couple poems in there. People afterwards were saying, yeah, let me, which one was that again? Where do I find that in the collection? Because I may not speak widely to a ton of people, but speaking with a depth to someone means a lot to me. And I appreciate being able to do that, sharing, a religion and a culture and a history. So yeah, I like Mormon lit stuff.
So speaking about your involvement with Mormon history, let's talk a little about what you're doing with the Mormon, with the church history department, rather, some of the videos that you've been recently working on and kind of what their purpose is.
Right. So yeah, I work for the web team in church history. Presumably your listeners have heard some about what we do, the history.lds.org website, Revelations in Context, a lot of people know. We did a Pioneers in Every Land video set people can find on that over the past couple years. That's stories of saints in different places. The most recent installment in that was about the first branch in Soweto in South Africa as the church is integrating, but the country hasn't yet. So it's still apartheid, but you've got these mixed black and white things. Super interesting. We've got interviews from people who were there in the early branches. And then, yeah, we're doing some stuff that's more topical now. Some people may have heard there's a new history of the church, 4-volume history of the church that'll be coming out over the next few years, starting with serial publication and then signed next year. And that Elder Snow explained at the Mormon History Association meeting, one of the things they want to do with that is make it kind of like a novel, meaning that you're locked in time with the characters in the thing, right? And seeing, we're not going to talk about sources and those things, just see what they see as best we can reproduce it and in that moment. So we're also doing some production of articles and videos to support that. So if somebody wants to, here you are in the moment, but if you go, this is new to me, I kind of want to know where this ends and how we look at it, you know, looking from the present back on the past, we've got some for that. So just recently shared with some people because they're coming up for Sunday school lessons and it might be interesting for people, a video we did on the Kirtland Bank that's on the Church History YouTube channel, and one on the 1838 Missouri War. And, you know, a lot of people are familiar with the extermination order. They don't always know that there's different periods of Missouri persecution. It starts in 1833, then this, we're thrown out in 38. So there's 5 years of kind of on and off. And then a lot of people don't know as much about the, you know, when did we lash out too, right? So we tried to tell the story not only of how we were persecuted, but some of the things we probably shouldn't have done.
Sure.
and give some context for that and help people. I think it's important when you're looking at church history, not just to sort of celebrate, but also to weigh what is it to be human, and then specifically kind of take on these constraints of discipleship under pressure, which we've got plenty of examples of in church history.
Well, we're going to link to a couple of the videos that you've posted, but with the remaining time that we have left, which isn't much, let's talk about your crappy podcast and your blog. You want to give us a quick plug for those?
So actually my master's thesis in creative nonfiction. So I studied creative nonfiction, writing essays or, you know, historical stuff, but in a creative writing vein. What I decided to do with my thesis was play with blogging. So I started a couple different blogs, and one of them called Mormon Midrashim, where the early blog posts are, I don't know, taking scripture and kind of making up stories that riff off scripture in this Jewish Midrashic tradition. And then I just got into talking about Mormonism and saying whatever I felt like. I spent all of last year in chemotherapy, and I don't recommend that as a recreational choice to anyone.
But
coming back, I just, you know, energy's a lot lower and all those things, so it was hard to blog. I have lots of half blog posts where I'd start to do something and just never finish because it was so exhausting. So I started a crappy podcast where I would record, and I just promised myself not to ever edit anything or listen to it again. And but I've got, I think, I don't know, a dozen or so episodes up where we talk about kind of whatever. I mean, one of the crappy things about it is there is no focus. So each episode, if I'm thinking about, like, what's the role of guilt in culture, I, you know, we did three episodes in a row on that. And then I watch Wonder Woman and do an episode on that. And I went on the visit to the Sikh Gurdwara in Taylorsville, Utah. It just kind of depends, whatever's on my mind.
So for listeners, we're not just denigrating it by calling it a crappy podcast. It's literally.
No, that's, it is James's Crappy Podcast is the name.
James's Crappy Podcast is the actual name of the podcast.
I think part of my problem coming out of treatment was that I couldn't live up to my standards. I might as well just overtly lower expectations for myself. And it was really therapeutic. So I've been a lot more creative since I labeled things as crappy. I don't know why more people don't do that.
Well, James, we appreciate the time that you had to spend with us today. And we're both happy that you seem to be pulling out of therapy really well. You're back on track. You seem to have some energy. And you're definitely, we're talking about before the show, you're productive and busy, one or the other. Sometimes both, right? but anyway.
Sell them both at once, but yes.
But we appreciate the time. It was great having you on.
Okay, thanks so much.
And that's our show. We'd like to thank James Goldberg for being our guest. We're pretty sure you're going to be hearing again from him in the future. This show is brought to you by The Cultural Hall. The Cultural Hall offers humorous commentary on LDS life, culture, and current events. Check it out at theculturalhallpodcast.com. Music for the show is performed by Scott Holmes.
And we especially want to thank you, our listeners. If you like the show, be sure to share it with your friends, your family, maybe even your dogs and cats, Brian, maybe even your ward members as well.
We're not discriminating.
So if you want to reach us and let us know how we're doing, you can email us at mail@mormonnewsreport.com. You can find us on Facebook. Just search for The Mormon News Report. You can find us on Twitter @TheMormonNews. And we'd love to hear from you. Until next week, we'll talk to you again after a while.